ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
In February 2020, Dave Cramer's good friend, Hannah Clark, was killed, along with her three children, Aaliyah, aged 6, Liana, 4, and Trey, 3, in a horrific attack carried out by Hannah's ex-husband. The whole country was shocked by the murder of Hannah and her children, but for Dave, it was personal. He was struggling with guilt that he hadn't seen the signs that his friend's life was in danger, for not being able to somehow save her and her kids. The thing is, Dave had grown up around domestic violence, but it looked different to what he'd witnessed between Hannah and her husband. So after her murder, he began the tough work of looking at his past and educating himself. And he's now a behavioural scientist working with teenagers, helping teach them what a good relationship looks like. And a heads up, Dave's story contains descriptions of domestic violence. Hi, Dave.
Hey, how are you?
I want to start with your own story, Dave, and what you learned about relationships growing up. What was family life like for you as a little kid?
My mum left my dad when I was born. No, my dad left my mum, sorry, when I was born. And that hit her pretty hard, and she turned to drugs as a way to cope with him leaving. And she had four kids, myself, my twin sister, my older brother who was 2 years older, and my older sister who was 6 years older than myself and my twin. And, you know, that was pretty rocky through that period. We didn't have a lot of safety around us. We were moving through housing commission and caravans and whatever we could to just have a home or a roof over our head. And so I didn't know much. I didn't learn much about relationships at that point, just what it meant to keep yourself safe and secure.
Did your mum go on to have other partners after your dad left?
Yeah, multiple. Like, so there were, I think she was probably with a new person each year after that. It was probably related to her drug habit, you know, who could, one, probably get her access to drugs, and also who could stop other people from harming her while she was there, even though those people she was with were also harmful.
Was there violence around when you were growing up?
Yeah, it was pretty standard, I think. I often reflect. I was just thinking in the car on the way here, like, what memories do I have of like fondness, of fun, of enjoyment in that period? And it's weird that I just don't grab them straight away, you know. And I remember one where my twin sister and I she jumped on my shoulders and grabbed the Milo tin off the fridge, and we sat down beside the fridge and ate Milo. At like 4 years old. But other than that, it was, yeah, there was violence pretty much daily, whether it was directed at us as kids or it was directed at my mum. It was a pretty consistent theme.
Did your older siblings sort of have a protective role for you when you were little?
Yeah, definitely. I think my brother took that role on at school, but my sister took that role on, my older sister, she was 6 years older, she took it on everywhere. Obviously, being 6 years older than me, she was 6 when my dad left and then just saw everything that happened from that point onwards, and who my mom was with and what these men were like, and had experiences of her own. And, you know, I remember when we were, I was probably 5 or 6, she was probably 11, and we were all standing in the kitchen at one of the houses we lived in, and she was standing at the kitchen doorway, and this man walked from the front door of our house towards my mother's bedroom. And as he walked there, he saw us in the kitchen and went to walk in, and my sister had a knife in her hand, and she was only 11, but she pointed the knife at his throat and she said, if you come into this kitchen, I'll put this knife through you. Or if you come near these kids, I'll put this knife through you. And that, like, I still remember the situation. I remember what it was like. And I just thought, you know, I was a kid. I was like, oh, well, she's got to do what she does. And now I look back on that, I'm like, far out.
How did that man react? What happened next?
Laughed it off, walked to my mum's room.
Was your mum able to access any help that you know of, like either with her drug addiction or with the violence that was around her?
I think a lot of people tried to offer help. I know my auntie and my nan, you know, both my aunties, her two sisters and my nan really did everything they could. To try and support us kids and to try and offer her help and try to get her off the drugs or get her away from the drugs. And I think it was a combination of addiction and what it meant to leave the abusive men she was with that kept her trapped in that space. Just fear and fear for her own safety and fear for what it meant to not to have her drugs as a way to escape whatever it was that she was trying to survive. And ultimately that help wasn't taken. It was more or less rejected, I think. And, it ended up in us being taken from my mum at... All four of us were taken by my auntie when I was seven, I think, 6 or 7 years old.
How do you remember that day, Dave?
Yeah, that was a... Well, it was an interesting... It was a weird day because my auntie had come over and taken us kids multiple times just because, she wanted to keep us safe and look after us. And we knew we would go to her house every now and again. But that day was a bit different because instead of just like taking the clothes on our back and a couple of extra pieces, we were given a black garbage bag each and just told to stuff it with whatever clothes we could or whatever things we wanted to take with us. And I think there was messaging around, we won't be able to come back for it. We won't get it back, that kind of thing. And so we filled the bags. We had a garbage bag each. We put it in the car. And I just remember sitting in the car. I was closest to the window and like myself and my sister, my twin sister, we were pressed against the window of the car looking up at my mum at the top of the stairs while she screamed and cried. And we just thought, why? Why is she so upset? We do this all the time. But there was also this feeling of this is it. Like this is the end of whatever this was and now we're going with my auntie.
How did you come to understand that this was going to be a more permanent change living with your auntie?
I think we just stayed there for the most part. Like we didn't go home again.
Did anyone talk to you about what was happening?
In part. So I think there was like we were around conversations about it, but I don't think they ever spoke to us through it. I don't remember it that way. I don't remember them sitting down and saying, I do remember a couple of conversations, we're just going to stay here now. It's going to be us now. And I remember the day that my auntie and uncle came home from court when there was a custody dispute over who us kids would go to. And the message was basically no one else wants us. So we'll go in with my auntie. She did want us, but it was like, mum and dad didn't show up to court. They didn't show any, way of changing their lifestyles to support having children. And my auntie said, if she didn't take us, then we're probably going to be split up into foster care or something like that. And that was when it became permanent. I think I would have been 7 or 8 when that happened. And that was when it was like, okay, this is where we live now.
And so from that point on, did you have contact with your mum?
Well, we did in parts, but because of my mum's drug habit, she was on the run pretty much from that time for whatever reasons involving, dispersing drugs or taking drugs or possession of whatever it is. She was always on the run. So like her coming to see us would mean that there's potential that someone... the police could be there to arrest her or something like that. So, or us going to see her would mean that she's known where she is. And so she was constantly moving around on the run and we were just told that we wouldn't see her.
Did she ever end up spending time in jail?
Yeah. So I think between 10 and 12 years old, we found out that mum was going to jail. And, well, I think we were told, like, my memory now, like, I've got, obviously, I'm 39 now, so I'm sort of combining the what I heard when I was 10 to 12 years old and what I found out when I was, like, 20. And what I heard, I think, was she's going to rehab to work through a drug problem. And then later on in conversations I'd had with my mum long after that, when I was in my 20s, she said, no, I never went to rehab, I went to jail. I was in jail for a couple of years, and this is what it was like.
So what were things like at your auntie's place? Was it a more secure kind of home?
It was, yeah, definitely at first. My auntie was with a man at the time, as my auntie and uncle, as I knew them. And so we had like what I would think was like a normal childhood, like between the age of 7 and 11, I think. It was pretty normal. Normal's a weird word to use, but like, you know, you go to school, you have a few issues with money here and there, but largely you have an income, you have a roof, you don't have as many concerns around rent and, you know, where are we going to live tomorrow? We had a house that we were renting for 2 years. We were there for the whole time. And then my auntie left my uncle and things went a bit downhill from that point again because there was no secure income. So we were poor again. I learned some lessons about how to manage money based on Centrelink cycles and those sorts of things. And we had to take on different responsibilities as kids because my auntie, I guess, stepped back into her youth, went back into dating, and she met a guy who lived a little bit further away. We were living on the north side of Brisbane and he lived towards Ipswich. So she spent a bit of time with him and my sister kind of stepped in, my older sister stepped in as like a carer kind of thing with, you know, paying for school lunches and taking us to the movies every now and again. And my brother also worked, so most of his income went towards food, like dinners or whatever else if my auntie was away. So there was still some, I mean, she did the best she could. And she was a great person for me to look to for like direction and what I needed to focus on. But sometimes there was that insecurity again.
Were there teachers or anyone at school who had any idea about the sort of stuff that you were facing at home?
That's a good question. I don't know. I know that we didn't go to school a lot when I was in grade one, when my mum had me. I remember taking homework sheets home when I was six and then just hiding in my bedroom and doing the homework sheets and then taking them back to school and then giving them to my teacher and just getting that, you know, that praise that I was craving as a little kid, you know, just someone to say, oh, well done, Dave, good boy, whatever it is. Yeah, I know we didn't go to school a lot. So I don't know that there was a lot of understanding. Maybe there was, maybe someone knew, maybe they were having conversations with people that we didn't know about.
When you were living with your auntie, were you able to go to school more regularly? That little boy who was doing his homework sheets, did he get to participate more in school?
Yeah, definitely. We had a lot more time at school. By that point, I had seen school as like a way forward. Like, this is how I'm going to get ahead. I'm going to focus on study. I'm going to focus on being intelligent. There's a pathway there. And school also gave me access to sport. It gave me access to friends. I know for a lot of kids these days, school is like, they feel like, oh, I don't want to, like, I hate that place. So not even these days, always. It's always kind of been like, a lot of young people have been like, forget school. But for me, it was like, I can get away from everything else and go to school and just have 6 hours of like hanging out with friends and doing well in schoolwork and playing sports that I like to play. And there was a lot of positive stuff in that space.
What sport were you into as a kid?
Athletics and rugby league. Yeah, I played rugby league pretty much from 7 to 27. And I was pretty quick. I was pretty fast. So athletics, the 100, 200 were my favourite events. I'm pretty inspired by Gout at the moment. But, they were my go-to events.
And what about coaches in that world, like in rugby? What kind of connections did you have there?
Yeah, there's definitely one in particular. Michael Woods, he was my coach. When I was in Colts in senior footy, like, so my first coach that I had when I was 17, 18, 19, playing senior footy. And he invested in attitude. That was his approach to who we would pick for the team. And so what he cared about was my attitude and how I took to running on the field and how I ran alongside the guys I played alongside and whether or not I was a team player, whether or not I was a good person. That is what he held true to. And, you know, I was on a scholarship when I first started playing for North with Melbourne Storm and then dropped that scholarship as I left school. But there were a lot of players who at North's at the time where I was playing were on contract with Melbourne, but he would only put forward the team he thought would be full of good people, good attitude.
Did you dream about making a go of it professionally?
You know, I saw this comedian the other day talking about how men never give up the dream of being a professional athlete,
it's
no matter how old they get. And I was like, this actually kind of hits home, right? Because I wanted to be a professional, especially when I got that scholarship kind of contract when I was 16. I thought, you know, I'm going to play NRL one day. Then I realized that so many other people got one and it was really hard. And then I was like, oh, I don't know if I have what it takes. And then I started doing CrossFit and I was like, oh, maybe I can, you know, push ahead with that. And then, you know, just wasn't fit enough. Same with footy, I wasn't good enough. And then now I do jiu-jitsu and I'm like, maybe I could compete in jiu-jitsu.
Masters games.
Exactly. And so it's, I think no matter what, just in the back of my mind, I think of myself as someone who can compete at the top level. But the reality is that I'm a hobbyist. I'm someone who just enjoys being active and I should just focus on that and be good at what I'm actually, you know, invested in my career.
So when you finished high school, Dave, what were your plans for the future?
I don't know. I didn't have any plans. I was like, I'll find something. I think I wanted to go to university. I went to uni straight out of school, but that was just because that's what you're supposed to do. And then I was playing footy with a guy who, he was our club captain, and he ran a personal training course. And he said, you should give it a shot. And so I started doing the personal training course. I completed that after a year or two and then got into PT. And I did that right up until 2020.
What was going on for you personally in those years, in your early 20s? So I'm imagining from the outside you looked super fit and strong. You've got this career you're building in as a personal trainer. How are you doing emotionally?
I don't think I was ever doing well emotionally, ever. I can't remember. I think from the age of 13 to 20, not till to 30, being like, things are good, I am happy. Before 13, I'm not sure. I remember going to school one day when I was 15 and one of my mates said, man, you've got to stop being so depressed all the time. And I didn't even know that that's how I was showing up, but it was everywhere. And it was weird because it was like, you're not happy. People aren't happy. No one is. That was the mindset I had, that you just got to do the best with what you've got. And yeah, if all else fails, then there's no future ahead.
Well, when I think about the childhood you'd had growing up, witnessing really awful violence towards your mum, being the target of violence as well, I mean, you must have carried all that trauma. Did you get help? Were you seeing a psychologist or a counsellor in your 20s?
No. I think, so I remember there's one memory I have when I was four, and it was my mum being beaten by the man she was with at the time. And he was holding her down and he was striking her with everything he had. And I was standing in the doorway with my twin sister, my brother and my older sister, and just screaming. And I knew they were screaming and I was screaming, my mum was screaming. And at the time it was confusing because I knew it was wrong. I didn't know why. And I just remember the feeling of looking at my brother and my sisters and it just feeling powerless to stop what they were feeling or to fix what they were feeling. And then this guy gets up and shuts the door in our face and goes back and continues. And just feeling like I was completely helpless. There's nothing I could do. And that memory has just played over and over. Just that sense of helplessness and powerlessness. And there were other things that had happened throughout my childhood that I'd felt that same sense of powerlessness. And by the time I was a teenager, that's how I felt just as a person. Like, and it wasn't like you need power or that I needed power. It was that not having it meant that I was worthless. And I see that today for a lot of young men.
So was going to the gym almost what you did instead of going to a psychologist? Was that the way you looked for meaning or validation or something?
Yeah, I mean, you get that message when you're young. Like as a boy, I got the message, go to the gym and you'll be fine, right? Like whatever you're struggling with, just go and do a workout and you'll feel better. And the issue with that advice is that it's true, right? That it works. It helps to regulate feelings. And I try to talk about this when I'm speaking to others who maybe struggle with the same thing, because there's a difference between feelings and emotions, right? We can regulate dysregulated feelings like intense heart rate or a tight chest or even feeling sweaty palms or nerves or whatever it is. We can regulate that through physical activity, through breathing exercises, through connecting with someone or sitting with someone. But emotions are attached to beliefs, and you can't regulate a belief by going and doing a workout. Sometimes you can reinforce a belief by going and doing a workout. If I just do this gym work and I just get those muscles, I will be worth something to someone else one day. And so it doesn't help you. It helps you to regulate the feeling, but it doesn't help you to regulate the emotion. And that's why, you know, I think for a lot of us, we gravitate to the gym because we think it's helping us and we think it's our go-to and it's our space out. And then, and as men and boys, we're told that you're not supposed to talk about it. You're supposed to deal with it in other ways by investing in your work, investing in your gym, or looking a certain way, or getting attention from women. And instead of actually talking about what we struggle with, we just distract ourselves from that. Gambling, drugs, alcohol, all of these issues that men struggle with. And so I eventually had to come back to the point where I needed to talk about it when I was about 30.
How did you first meet Hannah Clark?
So I met Han through the CrossFit gym she owned with her then partner. I was working in a gym with a guy who was friends with Hannah's then partner, and I went and did some Friday afternoon workouts with them. And then eventually I went to the Saturday morning class, which is one was kind of run by both Han and her then partner. And then we... and then we just connected over those years. Those the first couple of years I was just training at the gym. It was just pretty standard, like you knew everyone and everyone knew you and all that sort of stuff. And then it got to the point where I was actually starting to compete with where Han was. Like, she was quite fit. She was incredibly good at a lot of CrossFit stuff, very good at gymnastics, very good at strength and the fitness. She was incredibly fit. So I wasn't, right, good at most things. I was fit, but the skill stuff I was behind.
So what is CrossFit when you...
Yeah.
Using that term, what does that mean?
So CrossFit is a lot of movements done at high intensity to try and demonstrate your level of fitness. And it combines worlds of gymnastics, Olympic lifting, strength and conditioning, and your ergonomic kind of movements like rowing and bikes and running and those sorts of things. So it's really a combination of a whole bunch of things, and people just come up with workouts that might be hard and are hard, and then we all compete against each other to be better at doing more reps.
I just want to lie down hearing you say that, but yeah. And so Hannah was great at this, was she?
Yeah, she was very good because she had a gymnastics background, doing trampolining, and so some of the movements like handstand walks, for example, she could do that for days. Right? She could walk around town on her hands, no problem at all. And that was something I struggled with at the beginning, having, you know, only done a few handstands as a kid, never really learned any of that sort of stuff. And she taught me, thankfully, how to do it and how to do it well.
What was she like as a teacher?
Patient and funny. Patient and funny. She knew when to make a joke about, you know, stuffing up something, and knew when that she needed to be like, it's all right, you'll do better next time. Really good balance of understanding where you are at mentally and where you're at physically, and trying to give you the push, whether it be through humour or through just that encouragement you might need to go to the next level.
And as you got to know her better, Dave, what kind of friend was she? What was she like?
Yeah, same again. She was patient and she was kind. She was funny, very funny. I don't know if memes are still a thing, but the timing of memes and the timing of reels was always pretty impeccable. After a workout, I might have done something dumb in a workout and she'd send me something funny to say, this is you, or something like that, which was pretty good. But it was pretty much a laugh a minute. It was always a good time. And, yeah, great training partner as well.
What about her children? Did you get to know them?
Yeah, I did. So the first few years training alongside them, obviously the kids weren't there, and they came along, Aaliyah first and then Leanna, then Trey. And once they'd all come along, they'd started to be around us more. They were, you know, bigger kids. It got to the point where I would go in early before the normal gym class and I would train with Hannah, her then partner, and the kids would be there. And so I would be driving into the gym. I remember in like the last year of my training, this was a routine, probably four or five times a week. I'd be driving into the gym and I just hear little Leanna's voice from the gym yelling out, Dave's here, Dave's here. And it was just, it was the best feeling to have someone who's looking forward to seeing you, you know, just a little four-year-old person. And I'd park the car, I'd walk in the gym with my bag on my shoulder, and she'd be first one to ask if we could play tag. And so I would drop my bag and then I would start running around and chasing the kids while I'm setting up my gym equipment. I'm playing tag with the kids and, you know, having a good warm-up. And then we'd do the workout. The kids would either be in the creche area where they're playing on their iPads, or they might be around us having a bit of fun if it was safe to do that. And then after the workout, Leanna was always again first to say, Dave, can you carry me? Can you carry me to the car? And so I pick her up, and then Aaliyah wants to be carried, so I'd pick her up, and then Trey wants what his sisters want, so he'd be like, carry me, and then I'd have to put Aaliyah down, pick Trey up, and then Aaliyah would jump on my back. So I'd have one kid in each arm and one kid on my back, and we'd walk out to the car.
As you got to know the family, Dave, what did you observe about Hannah's relationship with her husband?
So if I can talk from the perspective of where I was, right? When I think about it at the time, these were kind of excuses, right? They were like, he's a bit insecure. He's a bit of a control freak. It's just the way he is. That was the kind of attitude I had towards it. Like, he wanted things to be his way. Anytime the kids were disruptive, he would make it her fault. It's your fault that the kids are doing this. If it was mid-workout, she would have to stop the workout to go and tend to the kids. And my perspective at the time was, that makes sense. She's the mum, right? It's not where I am now, but at the time it just looked like just the way relationships kind of were, given everything I'd seen before.
Would he get angry in front of other people, angry at Hannah?
Yeah. Yeah, that I don't think there's anyone who would say they hadn't seen him be angry at her in front of them. It was often in relation to the kids. Sometimes, like, there were a couple of, you know, awkward moments for everyone when there would be an argument they might have had the day before that had spilled over into that morning workout, and the way that there was this dynamic between them, and she was trying to avoid him, and he would make snide comments about her, or during the workout or at the cafe afterwards. Every Saturday we would have breakfast together as a squad, and yeah, and he was just like, ugh. And we might talk to each other about it later and say, that was a bit off, that was a bit weird, but just relationship troubles, right?
I think about the kind of relationships you grew up around as a kid. I mean, did that shape your understanding about what was normal, about what conflict looked like between people?
Yeah, it did. Because I think as a kid, when I grew up in violence, like physical violence, when someone is being controlling or someone is saying degrading things about their partner, or someone is even complaining about them not being adequate as a partner, that didn't, in my mind, say this is a problem. It was normal. It's so hard to say that now. I was like 20 whatever to 31 or 32. Like, I was an adult man, and I thought that was just normal for relationships. There was so much out there that could have told me that that's not normal, that's okay. And I understand I had this childhood and I had this life of insecurity that said that this is the way men react to being insecure in their relationships and it's normal. But just because I had that doesn't excuse how I showed up then, given the fact it was all there to be understood.
Did Hannah ever ask you for help?
I don't think she directly said, I need help at any point. She'd sent me a message once saying, it's been really hard because he's been behaving in this way, and I just don't know what I want to do here. I don't know if I want to stay or work through it, or if I want to move on. And I remember replying to that message and saying, hey, I know you want to talk about this sort of stuff. I just don't think I should be the person you talk about that with. You've got your good friends, but if you speak to me, I don't know that I'm going to make this. I feel like I'm going to make things worse, because I at the time had these beliefs about men and relationships and what I thought was normal in terms of who men and women should talk to when they go through that type of thing. And if you're in a relationship, regardless of who your friend circle is, you lean on women for that type of thing. And it was really gendered beliefs that I've worked through and deconstructed and have very different beliefs about now. But at the time, it was like, I think if you talk to me about these relationship problems you're having, he's going to see that as you're talking to another man about this stuff. Yeah, like a betrayal of their relationship or something, which is ridiculous, given I was just her friend and I was there to, I wanted to be there to support her. And I said, I want to be able to support you. I just don't think I can do it like this.
Hannah did end up leaving him and with her kids, her three children, moving back to her parents' place. What was your relationship like, your friendship like, after she left Baxter and moved back to her mum and dad's?
You know, I remember the first conversation she had with me after she'd left him around what she'd spoken to with the police, and she told me, you know, they showed me this pamphlet and it was about domestic violence, and I was like, that's my life, this is what I live. And in the back of my mind I was like, that can't be right, because my life of domestic violence was physical violence and assaults and lots of other things, and I was like, no, but domestic violence isn't like a jealous husband or someone who is trying to stop you from leaving or someone who tells you what to wear or whether or not you can go out with your friends or any of that sort of stuff. That, in what I thought at the time, was weird. It was insecure. It wasn't DV. I'm very thankful that I never said that to her. I remember saying to her at the time, that sounds really hard. What can we do about it? That was kind of where I could get to with that conversation. And then I would notice that whenever I put up a story, like an Instagram of like my dogs or something like that, and Han would comment on it saying they look cute, he would also comment on the same story.
Her ex.
Her ex would also comment on the same story, because we're all following each other on Instagram. He would never comment on the one she didn't comment on. If I did a workout and I posted my time in my story for CrossFit, she would say, that's fast, or that's a good workout, or I'll have to catch that. And then he will comment after that, but he never commented on the other ones. And then I would find out that he's taken the kids without asking, or he's not brought them back when he was supposed to bring them back. And I was starting to draw these dots in my mind that every time I talk to her, he knows about it somehow, and he's then making her life worse. And so up until February, I tried to maintain the friendship, but then I decided that it looks like I'm part of the problem. I'm making things worse for her. Every time we talk, something's going down. So I'm just not going to, I just have to step back. And I did say to her at some point, I may have to at some point. She was really upset, deservedly. So, because it wasn't, her fault that I was feeling like I couldn't talk to her, right? But she was the one experiencing the consequences. You know, I'd already stopped talking to him because I'd seen what he did. He showed me the DV order that was placed against him with Leanna's name written in it and what he did to take off with her and put her in an unsafe situation. And I was like, dude, this, I can't help you anymore. I've tried. And I stepped back, and then on the early February, I stopped talking to Han. And then she sends me a message about a CrossFit comp. You know, I hadn't replied to a couple of messages. And then she sent me this one about a CrossFit comp because we'd competed together a lot. And she goes, I'm just going to leave this here. It's like an insinuation, like, when you're ready, let's talk again. And a couple of days later, she apologized for sending the message. And she said, I'm sorry, I just missed my friend. And I just sat. I sat with my phone in my hand for the next week thinking, just call her from a private number, you know, send her a message and just say, we'll you know, I'll chat again soon. Because I was just so afraid that if I send one message or if I make one phone call, he'll know, and then it'll just get worse for her, and she needs this space so her life can be better. And then on the 19th of February, it all got worse.
Were you scared that he was going to do something violent? Was that what you were afraid of? You were trying to avoid that happening?
I never thought that could happen. I mean, as I look back with where I'm at now, I could have predicted it every day, you know? But where I was at the time was, there's no way someone that I once chose as a friend could ever do something like that. And there's no way I could ever lose someone like that. So I just never thought it was possible. What I was trying to stop was her. Like, every time he took the kids, she was in pieces. She was like, I don't know what I can do. One time she said, do I need to go back? I don't know what else I can do to keep my kids safe. That's what I was afraid of. I didn't think it was going to get to where it got.
How did you find out that Baxter had killed Hannah and those beautiful kids?
I had a friend call me the morning that it happened. I had a missed call and a text from him saying, hey, mate, have you heard about Rowan? Give me a call when you can. And I think I got it just at the end of doing a workout, I picked up my phone and saw it, and I said, I'll go and check what this is. And I walked into the kind of quiet office that we had in the gym and called him, and he told me about what had happened. He's like, can you just sit down? You're gonna need to sit down for this. And he told me, and as soon as he told me, I was at work at that gym with a guy who knew, and so I went and grabbed him and said, mate, something's happened, and we had a conversation about it. And he said, is it real? Is it true? And I was like, I don't know what's true or what's real. So I went online and went on Facebook and started looking for media stuff. I saw a picture of the car, and then eventually, I think the other guy sent a message to Lloyd, Han's father, and he replied saying, yeah, this happened. Han's in hospital.
What were the days and weeks after that like for you, Dave?
Yeah, some of it's a blur. I remember the next day, because I went and picked up their dog, and I grabbed her and took her home, and I remember just waking up in the morning and seeing her in the bed with me, and it was real. Because I went to bed that night. Like, I was in so much disbelief that day. I was in shock. I remember talking. A friend of mine called me from New Zealand, a friend that Hannah had competed with, who's really good friends with her. She's like, is this real? And I just spoke about it. Like, I just spoke. Like, it was something that had happened. And she was confused. Like, if this is real, why are you just talking like this? And I didn't even know why. And then the next morning is when it really hit me that this is real. This really happened. And then COVID happened. So it was only a month before or 6 weeks before all gyms shut. And so I went back to work. I continued to work for those 6 weeks. I continued to pretend life was normal. And then COVID happened and I was given permission to hide. And so I did.
What did those months look like? What was COVID like for you?
I think at the time I told myself it was a relief. You know, I was lucky to have COVID, to be able to hide and not face the world feeling the way that I was. I was really lucky, to be honest, because all I wanted to do was just sit in my room and cry and just hate myself for not showing up. But I thankfully had my brother who just called every day. Checked in, and even if I didn't have much to say, he would still check in. And I think without that, I would have felt really isolated and alone in that space, and I was just so lucky to have him. And then after restrictions were lifted, I started to look for therapy, and I checked into therapy with a really great trauma therapist, and that was a huge turning point as well.
You were introduced to something called the MATE Bystander Program. What was that?
So the MATE Bystander Program is a gender-based violence prevention program. I have to give props to, you know, Alison Baden-Clay, Jeff and Priscilla Dickey, who after Alison was murdered in 2012, started these big conversations around coercive control and were able to speak at it from that gendered space, and their combination with the MATE Bystander. MATE was around before that, but I think it was their stories and the way they told her story and they spoke of her that made this real made public awareness, raised public awareness around it. And then in 2020, when Han passed, public awareness grew from that. And so the MATE Bystander Program really talks about not just what happens at the point of violence, but what happens at the beginning of the line and what are all these things that contribute to men's entitlement to use violence, men's violence against women, and what are the experiences of women in these spaces of domestic violence like. And so I started to learn a lot about not only what violence and coercive control looks like, but also what is the culture that permits it to exist.
You also started studying psychology at that point. How were you thinking about your own behaviour differently through doing the programs like MATE Bystander and what you were learning in psychology? How were you seeing your own role differently?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I started studying psychology, I think, in 2018. And so obviously Han was a good friend throughout that. It's probably something I should have said earlier in terms of who she was as a friend. Han was someone who would text me before and after every exam. you know, and she's the only person who would text me before and after every exam. There were times when I'm committed to study, I'm committed to it. So I didn't even look at my phone of a morning of an exam. And I would come out of an exam at 11:30 a.m. and I'd have a text saying, good luck, good luck, good luck, at like 8 a.m. And then a text at 11 a.m. saying, how did you go? How did you go? So, you know, that's how she showed up. And that's how she always showed up. But yeah, throughout my study in psychology, every opportunity I had within those courses, I looked in that direction of the culture that we live in that permits that kind of violence at the end of the line. There was a lot of underpinning kind of cultural things that I thought was really normal, like sexist language, sexist jokes, victim blaming, and like things that I had done, objectifying women, all of these things that as a teen, as a 20-year-old dude, thought was just, this is the way guys relate to each other. We just talk shit about women. That's the way we are. When the reality is that even though I never thought, like in my head, I'm like, I'm not going to do any of those things. Like if we think about it like this, we have rigid gendered norms at the very beginning of the line, what I believe men and women should be, not what they can be, but what they should be based on a rigid idea of identity that moves through sexist language and misogynistic language that polices people to stay in that space of what they're supposed, what according to these rules they're supposed to be. Then we move into other things like objectification and victim blaming and sexual harassment, then eventually sexual assault, then eventually domestic violence, then eventually murder. I could never see myself at that other end of the continuum when we saw sexual harassment, assault, murder, rape, any of those types of things. But in the other space where I remember myself sitting at a table telling sexist jokes or even laughing at sexist jokes or objectifying women with a guy who took every one of those steps. I remember standing in the gym and watching him yell at Han for the kids being disruptive and me sitting back and being like, well, why does she put up with that? Rather than saying, why is he so abusive? Like, why is he being so cruel right now? Why is he making this her fault? Why is he not being a caring and nurturing father? I never asked any of those questions. I just asked questions of what she was doing and how she was reacting to the abuse that he was choosing. And so at the beginning, it was like, there's no way this is a real thing. I was never part of that. I'm not the problem. I never did any of those things. And then the more I got into the work, the more I had these conversations and the luck I had to be able to do this work alongside two people, one who, she was a woman who'd worked on the front lines of domestic violence, services for women escaping at the pointy end of violence, and another who was a man who had worked in behaviour change, in men's behaviour change programs for more than 10 years, who'd lived a similar life to me inside the world of rugby, and I played rugby league, and growing up as a man, I was so lucky to have these two people, Dean and Hannah, by my side as I did this work, who would, after a conversation, say to me, hey, you phrased this way. Could you think about phrasing it differently? Because it sounds like you're putting a lot of pressure on the victims. Or they would say, hey, man, I noticed that you were, we had that conversation earlier. You seemed a bit off. What's going on for you? Can we talk about that? They would just open that space for a conversation where I could say, I think I'm the problem. And then they would help me to understand, maybe, yes, I made contributions to that problem, but I can make choices now that help me to walk away from it and also help to take other people with me.
So when you started having those kinds of conversations with teenagers, which is what you were doing with the HOLP program, which was set up as part of the foundation that Hannah Clark's parents, Lloyd and Sue Clark, set up, how do you go about having those conversations with teenagers? Because it's really tricky, I think, especially for boys, not just to be made to feel defensive as though they're being blamed, that something that seems minor, they're somehow being blamed for something terrible. How do you approach it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, initially I tried to approach it from what the research told me to do, and then young people told me it sucked. So I had to really get back to the drawing board and actually listen to them, right, and ask them questions and get curious about what their world looks like. Because when I wrote the first program, it was based on what I thought would be helpful for a 16-year-old Dave. But Dave being 35 or 36 years old at the time hadn't been 16 for 20 years, you know, so it was such a different world. And in those 20 years, so much had changed, especially in the online space and those social worlds that young people are experiencing. So I just went back and said, okay, I've stuffed up here. You have let me know that. Let's talk about it. What do I need to do different? What do I not understand about your world? And then I just started constructing the conversations around not knowing anything. I had frameworks, right, talking about rigid gendered ideas. Like, what does it mean to be a man? Or what is masculinity all about? What is femininity all about? Tell me about that. But it wasn't like, this is what it is, and this is what it is, and this is what you believe, therefore you need to change. Because they knew way more than I did. And if I stand there and try and tell them I already know, we don't get anywhere.
There's a lot of attention and fear around this online world, you know, what's termed the manosphere. What's your sense about what's appealing to teenage boys about some of those online figures and chats and their very rigid, very prejudiced notions of gender? Why are teenage boys drawn to that?
I think for all young men and boys, for all humans, we want connection. That is ultimately what every human being wants, is a feeling of connection and belonging. And when you're a young person who's growing up in a world where you feel like you're disconnected, or you feel like you're not, you know, all your connections are pseudo, they're online, they're not with real people, then you start to look for it, right? You start to look for ways to connect with people. And then there's these grifters who will say things that will make you feel like you're seen. They'll say, you know, men's mental health is a real battle. There's a struggle with that. Then they'll say, you know, you've got to be able to have to offer value to people because you don't have it as you are as a man. You have to prove your value. You have to earn money. Like, you can't survive in this world without earning money. Muscle and good looks will bring you good things. That's how they sell the message at the beginning. And any young man thinks about those things. Even me as a young man, I was like, yeah, for sure. Sign me up. I'm in. And then you move into it, and all of a sudden it goes from all of these things that you're looking for, all of these other people, thousands of other people, other boys and men like you who are looking for the same thing, and then saying the reason why you don't have it is because women are the problem. Women are taking everything from you. Women are getting paid more now, and that's costing you. Women are rejecting you because you're not good looking enough. Women are not interested in you because you're not proving your value. And so it moves away from like the center issue, which is connection and belonging, and moves towards how do we isolate these boys from the people in their life so that we can continue to sell our products to them and make them believe they'll never be enough without that next product. We have to get them away from the people that they're seeking connection from.
So how do you puncture that when you're in a room full of teenagers who are exposed to that kind of stuff? And some of them might be just on the fringes of it. Some of them might be right in that space. What do you say?
I think it's about understanding the issue with it, right? Like, I think a lot of people try and tell them that, like, the manosphere is bad, or, like, you know, these guys are misogynists and misogynists hate women. Like, there's no young boys I've ever worked in an audience with who have said, I hate women, ever. But they have said women shouldn't dress like that because, and, like, my girlfriend can't dress like that. They have said that I don't want to date someone who's masculine. Women shouldn't be muscly. Right. And so they can't join those two dots. There's a lot of cognitive dissonance there. And so I just get curious about what that means. And I'd be honest with them, like, you're allowed to have preferences for sure about who you're attracted to. There's no problem with that. But when you start saying to someone who you're dating, stop going to the gym, you're not allowed to build muscle, that can create issues because you're now telling them what to do based on how you feel. So what do you actually want? And what are you feeling? And what do you want to talk about?
You spend so much time around teenage boys, teenagers in general. Do you feel frightened about the future, hopeless about the future?
No, not at all. I think it's because I spend time with young people that I have hope. I think hope is just such an important thing because, like, the world that young people are growing up in is one where they feel like they're the problem all the time. But when they're given the opportunity to see themselves for who they really are, as the opportunity for a future that's better for them, they do show up. Like, I was up north Queensland, delivering some sessions, some school sessions. I was invited to the community to deliver sessions for four schools in that community and then a community conversation in the evening with the broader public. And one of the lads sat in on a discussion. He was probably in the year 11 or 12, year 12 conversation, I think. After the conversation, he went home. He grabbed his mate and he said, mate, you missed school today. You missed out on seeing this guy. Come back in the afternoon for this community event. And so there's these two lads who were sitting outside the room at first. And I was like, oh, okay, I should invite them in, but I'll let it go. I don't want to bother them. And then as I started to talk, they walk in the room and they sit right in the middle of the room. And if anyone's ever been to a domestic violence prevention event anywhere in the country, what you'll see in that room is largely a lot of women and largely a lot of women who've been in the industry for a very long time trying to support other women, or you will see survivors. You do see some men, but they're few and far between. You never see, rarely see 17-year-old lads who've shown up without their parents. who want to know more about this conversation. And they just sat in the middle of the room and locked in. And then afterwards, they waited until a few other people had come up and said hello and had a conversation. And then they came up to me and said, hey, man, look, we really appreciate you being here and doing what you do. We didn't know the problem was this big, but if there's anything we can do, let us know. And that's the hope, right? The hope is that if we give the space for them to be understood and to know that they can play a role in making things better, that will take it on every single day.
Coming back to your own story, Dave, when you look back at the little 4-year-old, 5-year-old that you were, how do you think about the journey that you've made?
I think the journey I've made would not have happened without people around me. I think at 4 until 30, I believed I had to do it on my own. Like, you hear all these stories about people who say, you know, I'm rags to riches, or I made it on my own, or I'm, you know, self-made. And I think sometimes we don't give credit to those who really gave us this opportunity. And it's every single one of those people who has been there for me throughout my life that has meant that I can be here today having this conversation.
You've faced some real darkness in your life. What brings you joy now?
The simple things, I think. Now I only look forward to, like, sitting on the couch with my girlfriend and our 3 dogs and just scrolling through funny stuff on Instagram. Like, I don't know if you ever see jump scare videos on Instagram, but they send me for days. And she will just be sitting there. Sometimes she walks in the room and I'm crying on the couch. She's like, what's wrong? And I'm like, nothing, watch this. So it's those simple little things, just time with good people and dogs and being able to laugh.
Dave, it's been really quite remarkable to meet you. Thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations.
Thank you so much. I really love being here. Thanks, Sarah.
Dave Kramer was my guest on Conversations today. And if you need to speak to someone about a violent relationship, then 1-800-RESPECT is available 24 hours, 7 days a week. This story was produced by Jen Leake and recorded on the lands of the Turrbal and Yagara peoples. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.